The following podcast is brought to you by the Communication and Media Studies Department at Dominican University of California. Welcome to the Inevitable Tremor, where we will investigate the truth about earthquakes and the next big one.
Welcome back to the show.
I'm your host, DJ Tremor, and today our guest is Professor Amy Young from DU and is a geologist and has experience teaching science and has worked in international hazard mitigation in the Bay Area with a non-governmental agency. Some topics I'd like to go over today are the advancement in technology, plate faults, the next big one, earthquake preparedness, and some frequently asked questions. So my first question is, how has our understanding of earthquakes changed over the past 30 years?
So like most sciences, with the improvements in technology, our ability to understand earthquakes and how the world works and how plates interact with each other has increased radically over the last few years, mostly because we have created tools that do a better job of allowing us to, you know, take a virtual look inside of the Earth so that we can see what's going on in there. And also because it can help us detect things that we were either too small or happened too quickly. So our technology has improved, and within technology that we had before, it's just gotten so much better so that we can analyze things more quickly and get data out to more people in a more timely manner. I think also the geologic community has gotten really good at sharing data across nations and across cultures. And because of that, it means everybody has access to a larger data set, so we get better information.
How has the architecture standard changed to make roads and buildings safer?
So that's a really interesting question. And I think it's something that most people don't know how building codes come into place. And so when we talk about trying to improve our built environment, remember that earthquakes don't kill people, buildings kill people. The way that building codes evolve over time is that we build buildings to the best of our knowledge using previous information, and then a disaster happens, and we come back and we take a look at the various buildings and we say, which ones did well and which ones did poorly? And then we pull up the building plans of the ones that did super well, and we try to identify the aspects of it that made it behave that way. And we look at the aspects of the ones that did super poorly, and we try to identify the aspects that made it do so poorly. So we think of building codes as something that's like proactive. Oh, you know, if we build it this way, it will certainly withstand an earthquake. And that's not at all how it works. We see what survives an earthquake, and then we try to harvest the good information off of it. Now, because we've been doing this for 80 years, we're very good at it. And earthquake codes around the world are actually excellent. We understand what makes something resilient to earth shaking. And that's what you're working against is.
So what makes it hard to predict the event of an earthquake?
So an earthquake prediction, for somebody to create something that's actually called an earthquake prediction, means you need to give three pieces of information. You need to say when it's going to happen, and that's, you know, minutes, date, minute, time, including seconds. You need to say where it's going to happen. And so when you call that out, you're talking most frequently about the location where the earthquake begins, which is called the epicenter. And then the third piece of information you need to give for something to be called a prediction is you need to say, how big is it going to be, which is most frequently called the magnitude. And what we can do with a great deal of accuracy is we can predict where earthquakes are going to occur, and we can even do a good job of estimating how big they're going to be. where they're going to occur and how big they're going to be are forced, they're constrained by how the plates are moving and how much motion has occurred in each particular area over the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years. What we can't do with any accuracy whatsoever is say when it's going to happen. In the geologic community, we talk about the probability of an earthquake of a particular size at a particular location over a 50-year time span. But when we talk about a prediction, people want to know it's going to happen Tuesday at 2:30 p.m., and that we can't do. Yet.
Why is California a vulnerable place for earthquakes?
The exterior of the Earth's surface is actually constantly in motion, and it's floating on what we describe as a mostly fluid center layer called the mantle. So the crust of the Earth is constantly moving, and it's being pushed around because there's a lot of heat in the inside of the Earth, and that heat is still trying to get out. And so we have described the pieces of land. We've broken the Earth up into large plates called tectonic plates. And these plates are constantly in motion. And on the edges where they interact with one another, we get all sorts of very interesting topographical features. And so sometimes when they come together, we get a string of volcanoes. And sometimes when they come together, we get giant faults that cut between two plates. And California is the only state in the nation, together with Oregon and Washington. We're all sort of one group, so not the only state, but we're right on the edge of the North American plate, which stretches from California across all of America to the East Coast, and then halfway out across the Atlantic Ocean. And we're on the edge of the Pacific plate, which is the plate that is just to the west of us. So where those two plates interact with each other in California, their interaction creates earthquakes.
What constitutes a major earthquake or one that is significant?
So there are actually two ways to define what makes an earthquake major or significant. And if you look at it the way that a seismologist would look at it, they would find a number on the Richter scale, which is the scale that most people are familiar with. So if you've heard somebody say it was a 4.7 earthquake or 7.2 earthquake or a 5.8 earthquake, that's the Richter scale. That's a way of measuring the absolute amount of energy that an earthquake puts out. So in general, something that is 5 or greater is considered a large earthquake, and a major earthquake would be something that was a 6.5 or bigger. But a different way of looking at it, which may be more relevant to humanity, is how much damage does an earthquake cause? Because the earthquake in various environments is going to cause different levels of damage based on the rocks that are there, the size of the earthquake, and how well the buildings sitting on that land were built. So if buildings are better built, you can have a larger earthquake with less damage, so it would be less significant. And if buildings are poorly built, you could have a smaller earthquake that causes more damage, which would be more significant to the people that are living there in terms of property and life loss.
Now I'd like to talk about some what-if scenarios. Is the next big earthquake going to cause a tsunami in San Francisco? Or what about the Golden Gate Bridge? Is there a legitimate concern of it collapsing?
So there are different kinds of earthquakes. So when we talk about earthquakes, if you think about two things that are moving, you know, you could move past another object in a variety of different ways. You could slide side by side, or you could collide into something else, or you could move apart from something else. And each one of those three scenarios produces a different kind of earthquake. And certain hazards are only associated with certain kinds of earthquakes. So the kind of earthquake we have in California is most commonly called a strike slip earthquake. And it's where the two plates are sliding past each other, sort of the way that traffic slides past each other in two lanes next to each other and on a freeway. That's different, for example, than the kind of earthquakes they have in places like Japan and the Philippines. In the places like Japan and the Philippines, the kind of earthquake they have is a collisional earthquake. Two plates are coming together. That's the kind of earthquake that causes a tsunami. So California's earthquakes are the wrong geometry to cause a tsunami. So the Bay Area could be hit by a tsunami that was coming from a different place in the world, primarily the Ring of Fire in Asia is where that earthquake would come from. But we don't really need to worry that our San Andreas Fault or any of the faults that are in California are going to cause a tsunami. The Golden Gate Bridge, California has excellent building codes and learned a huge lesson in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989 when the upper deck of the Bay Bridge fell onto the lower deck of the Bay Bridge during the World Series, where luckily everyone in the Bay Area was home watching the Oakland team battle the San Francisco team. So very few people were impacted by that massive earthquake event, which was the last big Bay Area earthquake. And we learned at that point about the vulnerabilities of our bridges and our structures. So we've spent the last 20 plus years fixing our bridges.
Now I want to talk about some steps for earthquake preparedness. What supplies should families prepare, and what do you do during an earthquake?
So in terms of preparedness for an earthquake, you want to make sure that you've got everything that your family would need for, let's say there was 3 to 5 days where you didn't have access to electricity, refrigeration, and gas for cooking. In California, it doesn't matter so much that we don't have gas for heating. We can just be a little bit cold, but we don't have freezing cold temperatures that we need to prepare for. So the big one on that is to make sure that if there was a disturbance to the water supply, that you have either enough water, like in milk gallons, tucked around your backyard or tucked under your house or in a closet in your apartment, so that you could drink that water for 5 days, or that you have a way to purify your water if our water filtration system broke for 3 to 5 days. Other than that, you should have access to food, and you should have that you can, and maybe a camping stove that you could cook on. And then you should also make sure that you've got something like a hand-powered radio that you could continue to get information on, or that you could use and you could crank it to charge your cell phone, assuming that the power went out for an extended period of time. California is in excellent shape in terms of preparing people for emergencies because we've learned over the last several years. So those would be the big things that I would think a person should think about having is like a go bag. During an earthquake, if you're in a building, you want to stay in the building, and you should. The biggest concern you're going to have in California is probably not building collapse, but it would be things falling off the walls. So for example, you shouldn't have anything above your bed. So if an earthquake happens at night, you don't get hit in the head by a picture or a mirror that's hanging on the wall. If you can get under a desk or you can get under a table, that's great because it'll prevent things from falling on your head. What you shouldn't do is run outside. And if you're outside, you shouldn't run inside. The most dangerous place is the 3 feet directly outside of a building during an earthquake because of broken glass coming out of the windows and falling onto the sidewalk. You don't want to run through a shower of broken glass if glass were to break.
to wrap this up, I'd like to thank Professor Young again. She's the geologist. She has a record of teaching sciences. This wraps up my podcast series. Thank you for listening.